From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the search area for wreckage from the Air Asia jet is expanded. Civilians flee fighting between Indian and Pakistani troops in Kashmir.
I think one has to recognize that over the last 7 or 8 months since the Modi government has come into power, tensions have heightened rather than reduced.
And we hear how the U.S. poet laureate Charles Wright is inspired by China's Tang Dynasty poets. It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. The head of Indonesia's National Search and Rescue Agency says the search area for the wreckage and victims of Air Asia Flight 8501 is being expanded. Henry Bangbang Solistio made the announcement at a news conference today, saying authorities are opening up a second priority search area in the Java Sea off Indonesia. Well, meanwhile, several large pieces of debris have been found and could prove to be parts of the missing plane. The plane and the 162 people on board disappeared from radar over the region more than a week ago. The U.S. military sent a second ship with special sonar devices to help search for the missing airliner. VOA's Carolyn Prasuti shows us how the search equipment is being used.
This is Towfish. It is a side-scan sonar device that is combing the ocean floor of the Java Sea, searching for pieces of AirAsia Flight 8501. Daniel Clark is a U.S. Navy diver who works with Towfish.
We can find things as small as a golf ball or, of course, something as big as an airplane using different kilohertz bands and our swaths.
Towfish is attached to the USS Fort Worth by 91 meters of cable. What it sees appears in real time on a computer aboard the ship.
Exactly.
Indonesian officials reported five large objects in the water as shallow as 30 meters, but the currents were too strong for divers, so Towfish was called in. It can be dragged by the U.S. Navy ship at speeds up to 5.7 knots.
The faster we go, the less clear the resolution we're going to have. The slower we go, the more clear it's going to be.
Poor resolution results in shadows like these. Clark says they will first deploy it quickly to find larger objects, then more deliberately for detail. Another U.S. Navy ship has been in the area. It helped with the recovery of 30 bodies from the crash. The Air Asia two-hour flight was halfway between Surabaya, Indonesia, and Singapore when it hit heavy monsoons. The pilot's request to fly at a higher altitude above the storms was not approved because of other planes in the area. Indonesian weather officials say the storms could have caused icing, which may have downed the plane. But no definite cause will be known until pinging like this is heard. And investigators can study the data and cockpit recorders of the black box. Carolyn Prasuti, VOA News, Washington.
Thousands of Indians have reportedly fled their homes as fighting between Indian and Pakistani border troops in the contested Kashmir region spreads. Reuters says some 6,000 civilians in Indian-controlled Kashmir fled their homes as of late Monday, with at least 10 soldiers and civilians killed in the past week. India and Pakistan have intermittently exchanged fire across a working boundary during the past months in violation of a mutual 2003 ceasefire, though both sides accused each other of firing the first shot. Tensions between the two nuclear-armed South Asian rivals rose after Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi called off peace talks in August. In Washington, a U.S. spokesperson expressed concern and urged both sides to engage in a dialogue to ease tensions. President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry are to visit India at month's end. Rafiq Dosani, a South Asia analyst at the RAND Corporation, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the reports of fighting and casualties are coming from the militaries of both countries and should be viewed skeptically.
Probably the case that both sides are exaggerating what's happening. I think one has to recognize that over the last 7 or 8 months since the Modi government has come into power, tensions have heightened rather than reduced. And that's really the disappointing outcome that one can take away from this repeated cycle of attacks. I mean, this is not the first one. There was 3 months ago a much larger one where the Indian government claimed that about 25,000 people had to flee their homes. So it's disappointing that the situation has reached this level. And I think that's probably something that the U.S. needs to be very worried about.
Is there a change in policy under Prime Minister Modi?
It's not clear because he started off with a very positive approach towards Pakistan and then on what appears to have been a whim, decided to make things more hardline and hostile. It's not clear whether he's playing to his own domestic constituents, particular components of them, such as the RSS, or whether this is under genuine provocation from Pakistan. I mean, it's all speculation at this point. But the reality is something has taken a turn for the worse and compared with pretty uncertain, volatile, and not generally good relations, say, under the previous government of the Congress Party, it's become much worse now.
According to the Associated Press, India says Pakistani troops committed more than 550 violations of a ceasefire last year, the most since the two nations signed the accord back in 2003. Obviously, there's been an uptick in violence. Who's the aggressor here?
We really don't know whether it's 550 or 55 or even 5.5. And Pakistan can also claim what it likes. And no one should believe them because the history on both sides is of massively lying to suit their short-term political goals. So there's absolutely no credibility one can give other than this repeated reports on both sides indicates that there is a worsening of relationships. Whether that's actually accompanied by much more severe violence and what's behind that is something entirely speculative. To the extent that it's true, my sense is it signals what I was saying earlier, a worsening of relationships between the two countries and something that, as I said, the United States and others should be extremely worried about given the nuclear status of both countries.
Apparently, Secretary of State John Kerry and President Obama will visit India later this month.
Yes, the 26th of January is India's Republic Day, and President Obama is going to be the chief guest. It's hard to see this being linked with that. I think India has reasons to try and keep things under control, at least till Obama visits. And Pakistan, which has just received a large amount of aid from cleared by the United States, also has no reason to particularly provoke Obama at this time.
Both countries claim Kashmir and have fought two wars over control of the region since they won independence from Britain in 1947. The Arab League is calling for both action and dialogue to prevent the chaotic situation in Libya from getting worse. Libya's representative to the League urged the world to help arm the Libyan army, while the country's parliament speaker called for help in protecting the country's oil infrastructure. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
The Arab League meeting on the crisis in Libya took place as a long-awaited national dialogue session of rival leaders in Libya was again postponed. Arab League Chief Nabil Al Arabi told delegates to the Cairo conference the solution to the conflict must respect the free will of the Libyan people, as well as the sovereignty and unity of the country. He added that the League supports Libya's legitimately elected parliament and the government stemming from it. Al Arabi stressed that everyone involved must adhere to the principles of dialogue and renounce violence and terrorism. He says a decisive position must be taken towards all acts of terrorism on Libyan soil, which are leading to chaos and a political and security vacuum in the country. Libya's representative to the League, Ambassador Ashour Bourrashid, said military action must be taken quickly to put an end to bloodshed and urge the international community to help arm the Libyan army. He says every delay in taking action against Islamist militias means there is less chance for a negotiated solution. He also urged the international community to sanction those who are destroying public infrastructure and impeding a solution to the conflict. The Speaker of the Libyan Parliament, elected last June, Akila Saleh, urged Arab states during a press conference after the Cairo meeting to take action to help protect Libya's oil infrastructure. Considerable damage has been inflicted on oil storage facilities by Islamist militiamen in the port of Ras al-Sidr. Saleh also accused Turkey of helping to arm the Islamist militias known as Fajr Libya or Libyan Dawn, which seized control of the capital Tripoli last year. Those militias have set up their own government, which is not recognized internationally. Libya's internationally recognized government, based in the eastern city of Tobruk, issued a decree Monday forbidding foreign nationals from Syria, Palestinian territories, and Sudan from entering the country to take part in the ongoing conflict. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
As U.S. lawmakers return to Washington for the brand new 114th Congress, Republicans likely will exert greater influence after winning control of the Senate and boosting their majority in the House of Representatives. VOA Cindy Sain looks at what this will mean for President Barack Obama and for Washington's ability to deal with pressing issues such as immigration and economic inequality.
After a Christmas vacation with his family in Hawaii, President Obama returned to Washington to face a stark new political reality. Incoming Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told CNN's State of the Union that the Senate will vote on a lot of things the president is not going to like, such as a proposed oil pipeline and energy deregulation. McConnell said the balance of power has shifted.
Now he needs to talk to us, and that's good, because when the American people elect divided government, they're not saying they don't want anything done. What they are saying is they want things done in the political center.
One of the new Republican members of Congress, Mia Love, says lawmakers need to pay more attention to voters.
You know, we have faced dysfunction because people on both sides of the aisle have said, you know, we want Americans to trust us again, and we've got that backwards. We have to trust the American people again.
On the Democratic side of the aisle, Senator Elizabeth Warren strongly disagrees with the Republican agenda, saying Congress needs to focus on the nation's disadvantaged.
Washington already works really well for the billionaires and the big corporations and the lawyers and the lobbyists. But what about the families who lost their homes or their jobs or their retirement savings the last time Citi bet big on derivatives and lost? We were sent here to fight for those families. And it is time, it is past time for Washington to start working for them.
Analyst Stuart Rothenberg says Warren represents a growing populist wing within the Democratic Party.
The populist, anti-establishment, Democratic progressive left is developing supporters of Senator Elizabeth Warren, Mayor de Blasio from New York, the movement that wants to talk more about equality and fairness, $15, $20 minimum wage. That is a growing force within the Democratic Party.
But on issues such as immigration, Rothenberg says Republicans are more divided than Democrats.
So in that regard, the Republicans are more divided. The Republicans are more intimidated at the moment by their most ideological wing, the Tea Party folks. And so they probably have somewhat more blame for the paralysis.
As expert crews work on restoring the beautiful dome on the outside of the U.S. Capitol, some analysts say lawmakers on the inside also have plenty of work to do to restore trust and find common ground. Cindy Sain, VOA News, on Capitol Hill.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. The U.S. Poet Laureate is often described as the public face of American poetry. When the poet laureate is appointed by the Librarian of Congress, he or she is expected to bring the pleasures of poetry to the general public. Well, on that score, Tennessee-born Charles Wright is a pitch-perfect choice. He's written nearly 30 volumes of poetry and other works and has received nearly every accolade a living poet can get. VOA's Adam Phillips interviewed Charles Wright recently in New York and found him to be both mystical and earthy.
Despite his international renown as one of the most acute, prolific, and talented American poets of his generation, grandstanding is not Charles Wright's style. Indeed, Wright believes that poetry itself may be dying out as a serious and relevant art form, at least in the West.
It's going. We all know that. Because there's no real reason for it anymore, except that some people really like it. I mean, it doesn't tell the stories, it doesn't tell the story of the tribe, it doesn't do all that stuff it used to do. You know, those of us who get caught up in it for whatever reason and continue to do it, it's a blessing. And those who don't have anything to do with it, I guess that's a blessing for them. I don't know.
Wright has written poems on the landscapes with which he has become intimately familiar over the course of his 79 years. From the American South, where he was born and raised and lived much of his adult life, to Italy, where he also made a home, to the Rocky Mountains of Montana. Along the way, he's tackled universal themes such as love, spirituality, mortality, and art. He says he's finally lost the desperate urge to write that he felt as a younger man, and that that's okay. Wright's poem, Waterfalls, seems to hint at this.
Waterfalls. When is it we come to the realization that all things are wandering away? Is it age? Is it lack of adoration? Is it regret that there's no ladder to the clouds? Whatever, we inhabit the quotidian as we must, while somewhere behind our backs, waterfalls tumble and keep on going into the deep desire of distance.
What does that mean, the deep desire of distance? It's so sort of, it's sort of almost like a code.
Our desire is always at a certain distance from us, I think, or we should keep it a certain distance from us, otherwise it will overcome us and we'll drown in it.
Still, Wright has found what he calls a spiritual connection with China's Tang Dynasty poets, who lived between the 7th century and the early 10th century.
Because they always wrote about the landscape. They were always part of the landscape. They were always writing about what it meant to them. They didn't try to get behind it. They just tried to describe it, you know. But by describing it minutely and perfectly, you get behind it, whatever it is.
Here he reads a poem about the Tang Dynasty poet Han Shan, whose name means Cold Mountain, after the mountain where he also lived.
Cold Mountain and Cold Mountain became the same thing in the mind, the first last seen slipping into a crevice in the second. Only the poems remain, scrawled on the rocks and trees. Nothing's undoing among the self-stung unfolding of things.
Poetry can seem opaque to those unfamiliar with its witchy charms and difficult truths. But unlike poets laureate of the past, Wright does not see himself as an activist for poetry per se. He does not want to, in his words, sit around and laureate. But Wright does have empathy for those who want to test the waters.
That's tough, you know, because you have to have a certain mindset. It's not like the newspaper. It's got to hit you. You can't go out and manufacture that. You've got to read something, usually something that's beautiful. You say, oh, wow, that's terrific, you know. But if it's a hardship on you, then don't do it. Read something else. It's okay if you don't like poetry. You can still go to heaven if you don't. You'll get there quicker if you do.
As if to continue, Wright reads from his poem, Ancient of Days.
This is an old man's poetry, written by someone who spent his life looking for one truth. Sorry, pal, there isn't one. Unless, of course, the trees and their blow-down relatives are part of it. Unless the late evening armada of clouds spanished along the horizon are part of it. Unless the diminishing pinprick of light stunned in the dark forest is part of it. Unless, oh my, whatever the eye makes out and sends on its rough road trace to the heart is part of it, then maybe that bright vanishing might be.
Charles Wright is the 20th United States Poet Laureate Consultant in Poetry. His most recent collection, Caribou, was published in 2014. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
This is VOA News.
This is Today in History. On January 6, 1412, Francis Joan of Arc was born. In 1429, the peasant girl convinced local authorities that she was divinely selected to lead a French army to defeat the English who had laid siege to Orléans. She broke the siege but would later be captured and burned at the stake by the English for heresy. Joan is considered a national heroine in France and was sainted by the Roman Catholic Church. On this day in 1838, American inventor Samuel F.B. Morse, credited with devising the code of dots and dashes representing letters and numbers that bears his name, successfully demonstrated for the first time the electric telegraph, a device that would revolutionize long-distance communication. American poet and biographer Carl Sandburg was born on this day in 1878. Sandburg's collection of poems and his biography of Abraham Lincoln won him two Pulitzer Prizes. In 1893, a charter of Congress allowed the Protestant Episcopal Cathedral Foundation of Washington to establish a cathedral. The privately funded Washington National Cathedral was built between 1907 and 1990. In 1900, Dutch Boers fought with British forces at the town of Ladysmith in southern Africa's Natal Territory. The British soldiers, weakened by food and water shortages and disease, repulsed the attack but had to endure a four-month siege. The siege was finally broken by a British relief column in late February. On January 6, 1993, one of the originators of bebop jazz, trumpeter, composer, bandleader Dizzy Gillespie, died. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The optional protocol to the Convention on the Rights of the Child on the Involvement of Children in Armed Conflict prohibits using anyone under 18 to take direct part in hostilities. Recruiting and using children under the age of 15 as soldiers is defined as a war crime by the International Criminal Court. Still, around the world, 250,000 to 300,000 children are unlawfully recruited to participate in armed conflicts. 6 years ago, the United States enacted the Child Soldier Prevention Act, which requires the Secretary of State to compile and publish a list of countries that recruit or use child soldiers in their military forces or support groups that do. These countries then face legal restrictions on access to certain types of U.S. military assistance and training. But when a country takes significant positive steps and works to improve the situation, and it is in our national interest, the United States can fully or partially waive sanctions to provide an incentive for reform and may continue to work closely with those governments to end the unlawful use of child soldiers. Nine countries were listed this year. Syria, Burma, and Sudan did not take significant steps to prevent recruitment of children and will not receive a waiver. The Democratic Republic of Congo and the Transitional Government of the Central African Republic are making progress to reduce the recruitment and use of child soldiers. They received partial waivers, so has South Sudan, but for a different reason, to enable a ceasefire monitoring and verification mission and to continue efforts to counter the Lord's Resistance Army. Otherwise, the U.S. government suspended nearly all security assistance to South Sudan in early 2014. Rwanda ceased support of the M23 rebel group, which recruited and used child soldiers. Somalia has made some progress and needs help to fight against terrorist groups, while Yemen signed a UN action plan to end the recruitment and use of child soldiers. These three countries received full waivers. The waiver doesn't mean that they are not guilty of recruiting child soldiers. To the contrary, said Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights and Labor, Michael Kozak. It means they are. And therefore, the sanction and the law would apply, but for the waivers. The goal, said Ambassador Kozak, is not to punish countries for their bad behavior, but to persuade them to change it.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA editorials.